Blog Talk Radio.
This is Blog Talk Radio. It's a Wednesday at 5 p.m., and I want you to take a listen to this.
Tell me about Occupy Wall Street. What did you see down there? What did you take away from the trip?
We saw the voice of the people. We saw them. We saw the same energy that was in Selma in Alabama. We saw the same energy in the Vietnam War and the ladies' struggles and the African-American struggles for the vote. We saw that same energy. It's still there.
Did you draw inspiration from it? Was it that sort of energizing thing that we all look for in events of this nature?
Truthfully, it made me feel fantastic, man. It's part of our job. Part of our job is just to make you feel good and make a boogie. But part of our job is to be the town crier, the troubadour, and it always has been. We learned it from people like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and it's been something serious for us the whole time. And to go down there and start singing without any amps, without any band, with nothing, a little nervous making, and they started singing with us.
Yeah.
And they knew the songs, and they knew why we were singing them. And, you know, I had been down there before just to kind of cruise it and talk to people, ask them what they wanted, what they needed. And they said it would lift our spirits a lot if you did come down. And truthfully, I think that's what we did. And I felt fantastic, man.
I felt like I was
doing my job.
We just finished a 7-week tour of Europe.
Yeah.
And we talked about Occupy Wall Street every single night. And we thought, these people are going to understand. First of all, there's a language barrier, perhaps. But every time that we mentioned them, they cheered. I swear to God, they cheered.
Well, they're having demonstrations all over Europe. Bigger than the park. About the park. To them, it's as if they were watching America wake up. To us,
so far protesters have declined to be
starts to form in a solution when the saturation point
ends. I think we're reaching saturation.
Yes, it's a different pattern each time, but creating something out of what was seemingly nothing there.
I think we're reaching the saturation point. There's a magical thing also in that they don't have a single figure that can be pointed at and say, oh, This guy's the troublemaker.
What is about and where you think it's going.
I just came from there before this broadcast,
Zuccotti
Charlie,
Park.
From Zuccotti Park, from Occupy Wall Street.
People, I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. I've got two loops playing.
Asma Mahfouz, who is one of the leading Egyptian activists,
right,
founder of one of the people in the April 6th movement, who put up that video on YouTube before January 25th, before the Egyptian uprising, the major protests in Tahrir, that called on people to go down. There she was, her head covered, risking everything. A young woman, she's 26 years old, saying, come down to Tahrir. This is one Mubarak who had a strong hold on his country. And here she is today. She's running for parliament in Egypt, but she came to Occupy Wall Street to address the people there. It is catching on like wildfire now. 1,000 sites all over the world. I was just in Kentucky, Louisville. Occupy Louisville is across from the jail. People have set up tents. The eloquence of the young people and old who are there, who are saying this is a defining moment. I think of one young man, an African-American soldier just back from Iraq. He said he served in Iraq from 2008 to 2010, and now he's serving his country by camping out at Occupy Louisville. We are seeing something like we haven't seen before, except what, decades ago with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and it's something that's in formation. I don't think it can be predicted where it will go, but it is hot right now.
Could it be, in your judgment, a new American revolution?
Oh, I think it is happening as we speak. It is not just about what will it achieve. These general assemblies that are being held every day in these Occupy Everywheres, you know, whether we're talking about Austin or Boston or San Francisco, or whether we're talking about Louisville or New York, where people work by consensus, they consider issues, they decide what to do next, it's already changed so many people, given so many people hope. when they don't have jobs, when they see the educational system going down, and when they see their leaders leading us in the wrong direction.
Chris, add to that.
I think I agree with Amy that these people are very clear about what they want, and what they want is to reverse the corporate coup d'etat that's been carried out. This is a reaction, I think, to the collapse of globalization, which is ricocheting around the globe. Rising commodity prices, the reconfiguration of the global economy into a form of neo-feudalism, where there are essentially masters, a thin managerial class, and serfs. When you look at the conditions of workers, whether it's in China, and Ching-Kwan Lee has done quite a fine study on this out of Berkeley, you know, many of these people, you can't even consider them as integrated into the wage system because at the end of the month they don't even get salaries, which is why they'll climb to the tops of these buildings and jump off, live in horrific conditions. This is just replicated throughout the world, whether it's in the Philippines, whether it's in Vietnam, and it's this kind of race to the bottom, which is American workers are being told that they somehow have to be competitive on a global marketplace. Well, what it means is they have to be competitive with prison labor in China. And that reconfiguration into an oligarchic corporate state is already very far advanced. So I think these people are very, very clear that we cannot sustain ourselves, both not only as a society, but even as a species, if we don't confront the corporate state. I think it's a kind of return to sanity. I think it's a confrontation with dead ideas. I think it is a demand for justice, and I think it has an important difference between both the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in that it attracts labor, and it attracts...
Labor as in organized labor?
Yeah, and, you know, labor, if you go back to the 60s, was very antagonistic to the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. You had Meany and Kirkland, you know, supporting
George
Nixon's war,
and Kirkland,
right,
and
supporting
leaders.
Right.
Is it essential to reform capitalism, or in a sense to find an alternative to capitalism?
I think there are different forms of capitalism. There's the penny capitalism in the farm town where I grew up in upstate New York, where farmers brought in their products and sold it. There's a regional capitalism where you have a local business owner. Remember, small businesses are whacked by corporations and big banks that won't give them credit now. And then there's corporate capitalism, which is something else. Corporate capitalism is supranational, has no loyalty to the nation state, and it is, of course, hollowing us out from the inside. And I think Carl Polanyi sort of nailed it in The Great Transformation, written in 1944, where he talked about unregulated, unfettered capitalism as essentially plunging any nation into a mafia economy and a mafia political system, and I think that's what's happened.
Some people ask about leadership. Is it necessary to have divine leaders, or is everybody a leader?
The strength is that people feel empowered that they are their own leaders. But the creativity down at Occupy Wall Street here in New York, I mean, just look at the signs. You get the pizza boxes coming in from all over, so they take the boxes. They're very conservationist when it comes to being green down there. They take the boxes and they make signs. They say things like, it's not a recession, it's a robbery. Or, as you're talking about corporations, they say, we'll believe corporations are people when Texas executes one. We believe corporations, yes, are people when Texas executes one. And it's uniting many different movements. And although that has been talked about as its weakness, I think the opposite. I think that is its strength, because so many people are finding a place there. You know, corporate America has a problem when so many people have been disempowered and left out of the system. The joblessness, the unemployment, when people don't have health care, then they have less invested in the system. And so what is happening right now is you have people saying we must change it. They see all of these issues as linked, whether we're talking about the money that is going to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, whether we're talking about the lack of health care or the issue of global warming and the corporations that are responsible for it, whether we're talking about issues of racism, for example, when it comes to the death penalty. And that's its power. There's a place for everyone.
Are they the same stories you would hear overseas? Is it about dignity? It's about a system that is about an income disparity, about the evils of globalization. The same stories around the world.
Very much so. You know, when you have...
Those are the things that, you know, dignity was the... I was at Tahrir Square. I mean, dignity was a question that you constantly heard.
Yeah. I think that's right. And you know, we live in a system that is no longer democratic for the majority of citizens, and especially the underclass. It's probably best described as inverted totalitarianism, as Sheldon Wolin calls it, where it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. And in inverted totalitarianism, you have a system whereby corporate forces purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. We see that just in one piece of legislation after another, whether it's the FISA Reform Act, whether it is the Obama health care bill, which ends up being 2,000 pages written by the pharmaceutical and insurance industry, in essence the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for these corporations. I mean, look, just in moral terms, I mean, as a former seminarian, we live in a nation where it is legally permissible for corporations to hold sick children hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's the sickness that we've descended to.
They're holding their children hostage.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you can't pay, you have to sell your house, and you have to, a million people a year go into personal bankruptcy because they can't pay their medical bills. 45,000 people die a year because they can't get medical care in this country.
Do you believe, both of you, that it's been portrayed accurately?
Oh, no.
So what's wrong with the portrayal that you see and read?
I think the mainstream media has been revealed through all of this over these last 5 weeks as not being mainstream anymore.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the polls now, most Americans actually support these Occupy Wall Street movements all over the country. Most Americans. And yet the ridicule...
Because there was something unfair about the
rescue.
Because
there is a sense of injustice.
Right.
It is not about, oh, just go get the rich. It's about the sense of inequality. And a number of wealthy people agree with this, that they should pay their fair share, that they should have to pay proportionately as much as their secretary is paying in taxes. It really, I think, cuts across the political spectrum. And when you have a lot of the pundits you see on television, on the networks, you know, these people who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong, ridiculing the people in these encampments and saying, for example, seriously? Really? And yet the people who are down there who have very serious grievances, I mean, even... The young kids, a young kid came up to me. He was in high school at Mount Vernon High School, and it was about 11 o'clock at night. I said, are you sleeping here at the encampment? He said, oh, no, no, I'm going to take a bus back. I have to go to school every day, but after school, I take a bus, and I come back. And I said, why? And he said, well, because there's inequality, and I'm going to stand up against it.
Should there be...
I mean, is some responsibility in terms of to communicate. Should there be, therefore... a list of demands, or is that not, does that not serve the cause?
I don't think so. I think that...
They think there should or should not be?
It should not be. I think they've done it right. First of all, you know, as I just want to reiterate Amy's point that the non-hierarchical structure is part of its brilliance. It avoids the kind of cults of personality that plagued all of the movements in the 60s. And it gives everybody, it's cumbersome. I mean, these general assemblies can sort of drag on and on and on. But it gives everybody a sense of empowerment, and it makes it very difficult for the authorities to decapitate it. There are undercover cops down there, and aside from the fact that it's like a bad Doonesbury cartoon where they all look like cops, the other tip-off is they're all walking around saying, well, so who do you think the core leadership is? Where are the leaders? Well, first of all, it's completely transparent. You don't need to be an undercover cop. You can wear your uniform and go to the General Assembly, as many uniformed cops around the park do, and hear every word that's uttered and every decision that's made. And I think that that transparency and that non-hierarchical structure is really brilliant and gives it a kind of resiliency, and they rotate. You know, people will assume positions to facilitate, and they'll change so that nobody accumulates too much power. You know, I think that it's more that this group recognizes that the formal structures of power are tone deaf. And I spent a lot of time talking about this in depth liberal class, but the ability to carry out piecemeal and incremental reform, which is what liberal institutions do. You know, when Conrad Black wrote his biography of Roosevelt, he said that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I think that's right, that when there is a breakdown, liberal institutions provide a kind of safety valve. Well, the corporate state, in its myopia and idiocy, thought it could dispense with the liberal class. And therefore, there is no way to appeal to the system. It doesn't matter what the citizens want. There was no popular support for the FISA Reform Act, which retroactively made legal what under our Constitution is illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of Americans. There was no popular support for the bailout. Constituent calls were 100-1 across the political spectrum. But, of course, Goldman Sachs wanted it. And that is the bottom line. There is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And so when you shut that safety valve off, you create movements that seek to tear down a monolithic and tone-deaf and callous power structure. And that's precisely what's happened. Now, within that movement, I think it's appropriate for teachers and firefighters and students to make demands. But I think that the ability of the movement to, and of course it has great symbolic value being where it is at the gates of Wall Street, has realized that if we don't tear down the structure of the corporate state, it doesn't really matter what we do.
Does it have anything in common with the Tea Party?
Well, it's interesting you ask that. When the people gathered on September 16th and 17th, 2,000 people, hardly any coverage they got. If it was 2,000 Tea Party activists who had gathered on Wall Street, I dare say there would have been 2,000 reporters there, if not more. I think probably a number of people in the Tea Party are listening or watching because there are a lot of the same concerns.
The power of corporate America.
Yes, and
the
people feeling disempowered. I mean, I think this is not...
the power of Washington even, too.
Absolutely. And also there's a connecting with people all over the globe. This is a reaction to corporate globalization, not globalization overall, because there's a kind of grassroots globalization that's happening that we've never seen before. The protests are in the Philippines. The protests are in Egypt. They're in England. They're in Ireland. They're in Iceland. It is truly remarkable, in addition to Latin America and right here in the United States.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the young people they are learning right now, as they talk to each other and talk to people who come down to Occupy Wall Street. The other night I was there, and John Carlos came. He was, let's go back decades, Mexico City, puts up his hand in the Black Power salute. He and Tommy Smith, they won the bronze and the gold medal in the 200-meter dash. They put up their hands in the fist. He also wore beaded necklace to protest lynching, and they didn't wear their shoes, and they rolled up their pants because they wanted to protest poverty in this country. He came to Wall Street, to the Occupy encampment, and saluted the people who were there, that there is a movement that continues. And at the same time this all is going on, you have the dedication of the monument of Dr. Martin Luther King in Washington, D.C. Where would he be right now? Would he have been standing with President Obama as Dr. King was being honored? Or would Dr. King have actually been with Cornel West in front of the Supreme Court protesting the contamination of politics by money? Would he be in the middle of the Wall Street encampment with everyone else protesting war and protesting poverty?
Well, he died in Memphis where he was protesting poverty.
That's right. He was standing up for unionized sanitation workers.
Yeah. And so you think clearly that the answer to that is obviously be here.
Oh, I think there's no question.
Yeah. And President Obama made that leak as well. And there is some, I mean, are political groups going to try to sort of ride, you think, this understanding that it has power and therefore want to associate with it?
Well, whatever people want to do, at this moment I don't think these encampments can be used because there is such a freshness, there is such a decentralization of power. People can learn from them, and I think that the people who are gathered in Wall Street at the encampment as well as other places are reaching out to learn from those who've organized before, but they're also moving forward in this new era.
Is there a sense that finally there is a tension
that the mainstream media is finally paying attention?
Well, there's also grassroots media, and that's very important there. There is a media center. They're getting out their own images all over the world. Democracy Now! Has been there from the beginning, even at the organizing meetings before, where people understand they have to define their own narrative. And it's also very important to see how the police are dealing with this. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. Well, at the beginning, it was atrocious when you had police officers pepper spraying young women, blindsiding them, no warning, no provocation.
And many have said that gave momentum to the movement.
Absolutely. And more than 700 people were arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge. That was one of the largest mass arrests in U.S. history. As a journalist myself who was arrested covering protest at the Republican convention in 2008 and brought suit against the cities of the police in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the Secret Service for ripping off our press credentials, we just won a landmark settlement. And we held our news conference announcing this. Part of it is a training of the St. Paul police officers in how they deal with the media. We held our news conference.
They had to train their officers to deal better.
And that's happening right now. We held a news conference at Occupy Wall Street because we see what's happening. When police tell people to turn off their video cameras, that's exactly when they have to turn their video cameras on. Accompanying this movement, we need media in this country that allows people to speak for themselves. Ultimately, I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth.
All right. This also, I mentioned the book, Chris, Death of the Liberal Class, which you had mentioned earlier. I also, while mentioning this, also forward by Bill Moyers, Breaking the Sound Barrier by Amy. So there is, in terms of some of the programs that one of the programs that we did here, a sense that people ask this question: we've been waiting for this to happen. Do you have a feeling that that's an accurate assessment? People were looking for somebody to start, in the same way that there was an immolation that started the Arab Spring in Tunisia.
Yeah, I think, in fact, it's been something that has been happening for some time, but it's been off the radar screen. It didn't just begin in Zuccotti Park. It's ongoing. And it has been ongoing, but now it's finally erupted. And what's fascinating about the media is I think there's a parallel with the 1960s, where they just were asleep at the switch. They weren't doing their job. The New York Times, which is, it's a subway ride away, would send a reporter down there. They'd take one look around and walk back and write these sort of snarky, condescending articles, which they'd never do, by the way, to the Tea Party, because the political cost is too high. But because there is no left, in essence, organized left, one can ridicule movements like this.
Without a replacement of the organized left, in a sense,
I think it's different. It's a populist movement, clearly, and I think it's very different from the Tea Party. I think the Tea Party has very disturbing elements that I would call fascist. It, first of all, targets government and corporations, and is, of course, bankrolled by the most retrograde capitalists in the country, the Koch brothers and others. It targets government because corporations want government to become more anemic. It speaks in the language of violence and the gun culture. It directs rage, and it's a legitimate rage. These people have a right to feel betrayed, but they direct that rage towards the vulnerable, towards Muslims, towards undocumented workers, towards homosexuals, towards intellectuals, all of the sort of classic rubric that one finds in a kind of fascist movement. So while I think that the groundswell of anger that one sees in the Tea Party is genuine, I think the way it's directed is radically different from this movement. The channeling of that kind of anger, especially towards scapegoats, is something that frightens me.
There's no question now that it has enough momentum, enough support to be sustainable. And that the protests continue through the winter?
I mean, it's going to be hard, but people are very dedicated. And I think that the organized parties, the Democratic and Republican Party, are running scared. I mean, you have President Obama, who is elected by mass movements in this country. the anti-war movement. I mean, the major difference between Obama and Clinton was that he was opposed to the Iraq War. Now he is responsible for the surge in Afghanistan and the continuation of that war. Immigrants' rights movement had great hope for President Obama. He's now presided in his tenure as president over the largest mass deportations in history. More than 1 million people have been deported in his presidency. He promised to close Guantanamo. Guantanamo remains open. And he has surrounded himself by those who represent Wall Street, from Larry Summers to Tim Geithner, and people all see this. And that's how it's President Obama who has united, like President Bush did, people in many movements against him. And this is why the Democrats and the Republicans are very concerned. You see the Republicans changing, too. At first, they were not accepting this movement. You know, Gandhi said it, and I'll paraphrase it. You know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. And we're moving forward in that process.
And what do you expect of President Obama?
What do I expect? How do I expect him to respond to this? For me, looking at this as a journalist, I am much more interested in movement and how movements respond.
And
I don't think any of this is about one person. You know, I think the world heaved a sigh of relief when he was elected. For so long, people felt they were hitting their heads against brick walls. Now that wall was a door. The door was open a crack, and the question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? But that kicking open is the responsibility of movements, not one person. You know, if he's sitting in the Oval Office and those who are used to having the ear of the most powerful person on earth are whispering in his ear, if he can't point out the office window of the Oval Office and say, if I do that, they will storm the Bastille. If there's no one out there, he's in big trouble. And sometimes he may not want anyone out there, but it sure looks like the crowds are gathering. They're informed, they're concerned, and they're determined.
Thank you.
Wow. In
gee, guys, I hope that's it. I basically... it's day 54 of OWS. That was Charlie Rose from last weekend, I believe, with Christopher Hedges and Amy Goodman. An excellent conversation that I had planned to go off for the last part of the show, but I opened with it, so I guess folks have floated back and forth. But it is day 54 of Occupy Wall Street, and it's the first day of Occupy the Highway March to D.C., which that's wild, that's great, that's fabulous, isn't it? I mean, the only thing missing, and I plan to open up with that Oberman, you know, section of Crosby and Nash. I mean, they were heroes, about everybody I know, from that time and space. And they made it to the party yesterday, down with the rest of the 99. They did a piece last night on Oberman that I had recorded to put in here. You know, sooner or later, Jane Fonda and Warren Beatty are going to show up down there. It'll be great, won't it? I mean, we'll all ride into Jerusalem, as they say. You're listening to Here Be Monsters, one of a drumline of activist blog talk radio shows boycotting the MSM and supporting the Occupy movement across the planet, including these shows, Progressive News Network with Rick Spisak and Pinko the Bear, up late at night with Pinko the Bear from Reno, Nevada, and The Wild, Wild Left with Diane G., which is on Friday evenings at 6 p.m. They're all giving it up. We're all giving it up for the political spirit of change throughout Occupy Our Planet. And while yesterday notorious, and I say that for a reason, asteroid sped between Mother Earth and Grandmother Moon. You know, wow. Crosby and Nash showed up at Fuccotti Park into, quote, I mean, that's fantastic, man. I'd like to play a song of theirs, but we've listened to so much recording. By the way, yesterday, Ohio went and hugged the Union back. The vote went, I guess it was a pretty big landslide, towards union. That would be a big booyah for the Wobbly crowd. I think that's wonderful. You know, there's some moral imperative going on through all of this. It's that, and I don't think people are really getting it, but once in a while it comes up. It's like that what can you do for your country thing. I mean, I was taught, and I know a lot of people who were taught, that you give back to your community. You know, it's service. It's about being of service. And being of service to the community, if you've never tried it, it's really very rewarding. It's like being a preschool teacher. You get all these wonderful moments of miracles and surprises, and it just fills you up, you know. Sandy White is telling me that more people voted down issue 2 than they voted for Governor Kasich. So that I would call that a huge hug for the unions in Ohio. Thanks, Sandy. Appreciate that. Anyways, as I was saying, Occupy Wall Street addresses our service to the community. I think our sense of purpose in sustaining our community and the way we sustain the community, all these things are being addressed with the Occupy movement. And it's the whole planet that I'm talking about with the movement, not some isolation of borders and boundaries that are used to create profiteering by and for a bunch of fucking warmongers, you know. Washington politicians are standing in direct opposition to this kind of Occupy Wall Street reality or awareness or meme or whatever you want to place it in vocabulary. It's powerful presence, I think. They're totally tone deaf to what Occupy is and the momentum that it's achieving. That can, you know how you know that's true? Turn on your news, your mainstream news. It's in, and I include the, you know, ass wiping that Maddow does of Obama every night. That's gotten embarrassing, okay? I mean, the woman's smart. It's just gotten embarrassing. Anyway, they're convinced that it takes, as Mr. Hedges just pointed out, a cult of personality to achieve a phenomenon of leadership. When they don't get it, everybody is a leader. Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement is bringing that up all over the place. I see it locally happening. People feel very empowered, and they feel very strongly unified, which I've seen politically happen before, being delegate or what have you. But this is different because it stretches and spans so many different age and culture groups. Everybody feels welcome, and that's a big deal. That is a big deal. That's a game winner. When everybody feels welcome to the movement, when everybody feels welcome to work towards a political action that'll make a better world for them, when everybody feels welcome to honesty, that makes a big difference. And so Occupy is achieving that. If you really think about it, if you really look at it, the way that they think that this personality, this quote cult of personality, achieves the phenomenon of leadership, it's a complete misunderstanding to what it truly means to be an American, you know, individuality. I mean, this is my point of view, but to be an American is to be your own leader. It is to take up responsibility for yourself and also to enjoy the prosperity that you can bring to yourself honestly. That's what people come so far for. And that and the fact that they were treated so poorly wherever they ran for their lives and looked for political asylum. You know where I'm coming from here. So it's a true misunderstanding of Occupy when they don't get it, why every one of them is a leader. If you take a look at the Republican buffoons that are seeking to run against Obama, I mean, it's a laugh riot. You know, these people are, you know, in opposition to folks of capable of critical thought here. You know, you need that. You need critical thinking skills just to be a good American anymore. I think I saw that in a movie somewhere by Rob Reiner. Now, you don't have to be a genius, and you don't have to have a college debt to achieve that. You simply have to think for yourself. You got to stand in the front and say, you know, this is what I think. This is my opinion. And speak for yourself. And, you know, hopefully we learn to be humble enough to admit our mistakes when we make them, but we don't stop standing up and saying, this is who I am. This is how I think. You know, they're trying to take that away from us. They're trying very hard to take that away from us. It's a fascism that corporations, you know, I heard Michael Moore use the term wage slaves. He thinks that's what they'll probably call us in history. He's got a point. You like that? I don't like that. I hate that. But you do. You have to simply think for yourself. Yeah, I agree, Sandy. Critical thinking should be taught in all high schools, and there's many ways of getting to it. Yeah, you can feel me, huh? I think everybody else can feel it, too. But the Republicans, they don't want, well, they can't, they aren't really, I don't think a lot of them are capable of critical thought, and I don't think a lot of the Tea Party people are capable of concluding the truth, let's put it that way. You know, Tim Dickinson writes for Rolling Stone. He's pretty good, along with, you know, Ty Eby and a few others. He wrote a piece that got actually swiped by the Huffington Post today. And there's a couple of paragraphs that are really good, and I'd love to share them right now. I think they come to bear. Republicans talk about job creation, about preserving family farms and defending small business, and reforming Medicare and Social Security. But almost without exception, every proposal put forth by GOP lawmakers and presidential candidates is intended to preserve or expand tax privileges for the wealthiest Americans. Actually, it goes beyond borders. But and most of their plans, which are presented as common sense measures that will aid all Americans, would actually result and higher taxes for middle-class taxpayers. And you excuse me, my little impression of how to put this down, it's not just the poor, but cramming it right up the poor. With 14 million Americans out of work. Now, 14 million Americans is just the official lineup that they've got going. That's the official numbers that they're presenting to the public. I think that probably the most, you know, truthful would be closer to 17 to 20 million Americans out of work. Look at it. Well, hello, Diane G. If you look at it, some people, like good friends of mine, are working two and three jobs to get by. Now, that I would call an out of work American, someone who has creative capability or needs some kind of venture capital for a small business or what have you. That's just not happening anymore. Anyways, Mr. Dickinson says in one in seven families, well, I think it's more like, I think it's yes, hang on there. Oh, okay, Diane, P.E., Sandy, everyone in there, I hear you talking. I hope you can stick it out. I do think it's more than just one in seven. I think it's more like one in five or six families that, pardon me, are actually looking for food stamps to get by with. And by the way, I'm in the state where the SOB in the governor's office is – this drug testing to get this all done. Give me a sec. Oh, good Lord, I hope I'm not going on a coughing tear. Wouldn't that be just awful? Anyway, God, haven't had a Marlboro in 2 years. Anyways, the point is, he's saying that Republicans have responded to the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression in slashing inheritance taxes, extending Bush tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and endorsing a tax amnesty for big corporations that have hidden billions in profits in offshore tax havens. That's what Occupy Wall Street is doing in Occupy Wall Street. They've also wrecked the nation's credit rating by rejecting debt ceiling deals that would have slashed future deficits by $4 trillion simply because one quarter of the money would have come from the closing those tax loopholes to the rich. The intransience over the debt ceiling enraged Republican stalwarts like George Voinovich, the former GOP senator from Ohio, who likens his party to a new guard of arsonists whose attitude is, we're going to get what we want or the country can just go to hell. Even an architect of the Bush tax cuts, economist Glenn Hubbard, tells Rolling Stone that there should have been a revenue contribution to the debt ceiling, a structure to fall mainly on the well-to-do. And I guess President, good Lord, what's the white-haired dude's name? Oh, my God. Clinton got his hand slapped for saying the same thing in a book when actually that was proffered by the Obama administration. Instead, the GOP strong-armed America into sacrificing $1 trillion in vital government services, including education, health care, and defense, all the safeguard tax breaks for oil companies, yacht owners, and hedge fund managers. Yeah, sounds right. The party's leaders were triumphant. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, that guy's chin bugs me, even bragged that America's credit worthiness, and oh, by the way, is anybody watching the stock market? Aren't we having fun today? Has been, quote, a hostage that's worth ransoming. I mean, what kind of hubris is that? But also, how are they getting away with this? How are they, I mean, and I know Diane asks it, I ask it, I've heard Rick ask it. I've heard a lot of people asking this. How do they get it? Well, you can account for a lot of people thinking that they're going to win the lotto. They're going to have a lot of money someday, that the American dream will provide them. My mother used to say, you know, you think the world owes you a living. But a lot of people do think the world owes them a living. And so they want to be on the rich guy's side. They don't want to be standing on the other side of the street where you got to roll up your sleeves and dig in and create your world. It does take some creativity. Good Lord. But anyways, the truth is that none of these so-called Tea Party or Republican Party politicians are part of the 1%, you know. I'd love to have this conversation with Diane and with Pinko and with another friend of mine, Steve Gomes, the artist over at Journey with Roundtree 7. This is a subject he and I used to speak about a lot. Yeah, we're all just millionaires down on our luck. I could actually say that. I mean, nobody is near the actual 1%. That's something that the OWF really has together, saying that we are the 99.9% because we are, it is 0.01%. You know, the politicians and people like, they may have enough money to feign privilege in town and country, but they're nothing more than the boot lackeys to the real deal. And that is a scary let them eat cake crowd of generational monies that extend, I think, from just a small group of people out of royal lineage to the Vaticano bank boards. I mean, that's the real 1%, folks. And you know, I'm not going conspiracy nut here, Anya. I'm just saying that's the truth. There is a real 1% globally, and that's who it is. They got the most motherfucking, look at the name Windsor, you know, Rothschild. That's where the motherfucking money is, and they are the ones who are the back burner that owns all of the, you know, factories making the war machines and all that stuff. America is young in owning the world reality, okay? We're really young in owning the world reality. And the GOP, hey, they've just become a tool in that operation. Just like American bloodlines of Winchester, Bush, and Coke, they're babies. They're in infancy at it. Coke even had an anchor that in a failed attempt at global domination in recent history, you know. Serving Herr Hitler. That's an interesting show that should be done. They don't always win, the 1%. And I think they're more closer to being cleaned out of the evolving human story than ever before. I think that's actually very true. Lively conversation going on here. y'all should call in Mr. Awakens. And Diane, and go for it. But hey, it's like I said, most people, especially on Wall Street, very few chairs on Wall Street have that kind of 1% money, and it's just the truth. They're the bootlackeys to the real deal. They never see them. They just know they're there, and they feel them. Maneuvering them around on the chessboard. That's the truth. But for the first time, I think, since patriarchy began its stroll through history, I think we actually do have a chance right now because America is waking up. We're more closer. The 1% is more closer to being cleaned out of the evolving human story than ever before. I think that's true simply because the human species is at a trigger point. We're closer to extinction than we've ever been before. Not even when the blast happened that bombed us back, an asteroid hit us, then bombed us back into the Ice Age 12,000 years ago at the beginning of the Age of Leo, and everybody went back into, you know, the freaking caves, began to draw and paint on the walls and devolve a little bit, you know. But you can't explain this to a lot of the GOP or conservative folks because a lot of them actually think that 12,000 years ago there was nothing anywhere anyhow. I'm speaking of the scienceless folks. Anyways, it's the 1%. Like I said, it's simply that the human species is closer to extinction than ever before. And the 1%, they're guiding the murder of mankind. It's their profits that drive the poison, the destruction, the waste that can ultimately sweep all life from the surface of this planet. Now, that's just the truth. My goodness, y'all are having fun in there. I just looked over. I am, Diane, would you like me to take an action here? Just tell me so, darling, and I will. Anyway, I'm watching. Um, Perhaps it's for good and all that we come to this point. The seas are pretty close to death right now. We're living on some borrowed time, I think. You would think it takes brilliance to make this kind of money and to stay in that kind of percentage in the world. But the evidence suggests that it just takes exceeding greed and common smarts to do it. How else do you explain someone like Herman Cain? He's the pinhead end of the argument, a repugnant individual with an egomaniacal confidence scheme approach to run for the highest office in the land and spend all his money. But really, he's actually just selling stupid to the dim-witted. Greed is a big part of it. That's mandatory. You know? It's a huge part of it. I'm really... Okay, you don't ban people. No, I don't ban people. Pinhead is racist? Well, to who? Robots? Am I... What is the term for a robot that would comport with xenophobic? Y'all are having some fun in there. You know, Holger, racism against Herman Cain? No, he's just really a vulgar human being. You know, I worked hard to elect Barack Obama. Does that make me a wannabe black girl or something when I'm doing that? I mean, how does your logic run? I did call him a pinhead because he is. Good Lord. Take a look. Do you actually realize what I said? I was talking about exceeding greed and common smarts to accomplish money in this world. And I said, how else do you explain Herman Cain? I was not talking about his racial profile. I was talking about his, you know, common human experience. He's the pinhead end of the, you know, Republican argument. He's a repugnant individual using an egomaniacal confidence scheme approach to running for the highest office in the land, and he's spending all his money, and he's doing it because he wants to sell a book or sit on friggin' Fox News, which I think is going down. I think News Corp is going down pretty soon, too. But, hey, anybody looking at the, well, you can disagree. It's okay. It's that's what makes horse racing. That is what makes horse racing. But basically, I 801, I had the paper, in front of the other side of the screen, so I missed you. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. But basically, Herman Cain is not worth spending this much time arguing or diluting about it. Diane, I didn't even see you when I got to you were leaving, so I do apologize. I do want to bring up the good stuff, though. I do want to share that information. It's probably going to get right up Mr. Dovakin and Mr. Holger's collective asses here, but I would like to mention something else from another realm. Daryl Issa, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, is pushing for a federal probe of New York City community organization based on a Fox News. Yeah, there you go. There's some fucking due diligence for you. A Fox News report that accused the organization, we're talking about Acorn, of improperly aiding Occupy Wall Street movement and linked to the group, you know, Acorn. Mr. Issa can, and I hope you all can hear this very clearly, he can kiss my ass. Yes, that's the way I feel about him. and you can tell him as much yourself. And if you've got a pencil and paper, here's the telephone number that you can use to tell him. So in Washington, D.C., you can call his office, and it's 202-225-3906. That's in D.C., 202-225-3906. And in California, it's 760-599-5000. I don't think so, Mr. It's not ISIS, it's ISA, you know. Barry's days are numbered. Well, I'm not too happy with him either, Mr. Holger. I'd like to see him. Thank you, Tricia. Thank you very much for repeating that. I'd like to see that third party candidate myself. I do have a couple of other things here that I wanted to bring up, and please lend your support to Occupy the Highway. It's a march from Zuccotti Park to Washington, D.C., and it began today. It's a small group of, you know, I am sitting in here now in the total darkness of South Florida, and my Mac screen is the only thing illuminating. So basically, I've got a moth convention going on. So, okay, a small group of Occupy Wall Street activists will start a march Wednesday with the hope of arriving in Washington, D.C., on November 23rd, the deadline for a congressional committee to decide whether to keep President Obama's extension of the Bush-era tax cuts. You know, I don't know what people like Mr. Dovakin and Mr. Holger are so, you know, scared of what Mr. Obama is going to do, because frankly, fellas, unless you're blind as freaking, you know, church mice, and you can't see, Mr. Obama is the, you know, the brainy part of the Republican Party. I think you'd call it Karl Rove and his folk, not the yo-ho crowd of Koch brothers and Dick Armey, but the brainy part of the conservative right-wing moral majority, yeah, all that crap. They're all very happy with Mr. Obama's performance. They'll give him a gold watch by the time he's done. You can take that one to the friggin' bank. So when you talk about as dumb as a Pope, my God, really? That's as good as you've got, Mr. Holger? Mr. Obama, as dumb as a post? Jesus. Brainy isn't a word? Well, no. There's a lot of words that I make up all the time. I actually get paid to write, too. But here's the thing. Mr. Obama is as dumb as a post. That's as good as you've got. You haven't got any substantive argument to put forth, have you? Now it's Jimmy Carter. You guys are fun. You know, Diane, you've made it, right, when they get on board, right? Jeez, I wish you'd call back in. Sorry about your windstorm there. Anyways, we do have a support to Occupy the Highway, and anybody who can lend any kind of, you know, tweet, if you Twitter, lend your positive support to these folks. There's 20 of them, and they're going to pick up folks along the way, hopefully. It's a march to the through the 23rd, and the protesters say that it cuts the tax cuts that benefit only the rich Americans is their their goal in bringing any kind of attention to. I'm sure there's going to be some alternative media out there like there was for Sheree Foytlin when she did her march to D.C. It's Kelly Brennan who's been organizing this 240-mile march, and they're going to be going through New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland. And it's the core group is only about a dozen strong. But they're hoping to pick up people every day on the highway. And, you know, that's how MLK did it. So much, much luck to them. And a great deal of good energy sent out there. Oh, look who's here. Anyways, please send good energy towards these folks. Hey, are you laughing at me, honey?
I am. I didn't know I was on the air.
Yeah, I just cut you in there. Well,
When I first came on, I offered to call for you because you're coughing a little bit. I could hear you sniffling. I'm like, let me call and talk for a couple minutes. You can blow your nose, darling. You sound all stuffered up.
my roommate got the bug, and I think, But how are you doing? It's nice to have you here on Hear Me Monsters.
I love coming on your show, and I'm so glad that I caught it. You know, I've been trying to get a lot of work done around the homestead, and I've been occupying Detroit, as you know. I'm working on a food drive here.
Tell us about Occupy Detroit.
Occupy Detroit was marvelous. I went, I brought, for the listeners who don't know, my husband passed in March. And
mm-hmm.
I took all of his warm clothes. I took his sweatshirts, his sweaters, his coats. I was brutal in a way that I probably could have been brutal if I didn't know there were cold people who needed it. And me and my son went. And what a thing for him to take this loss and go, we're keeping people warm with Daddy, you know.
Oh, wow.
So we took four huge bags of his clothes and coats down there. And
nice.
Then we had taken stuff out of my mother-in-law's house, and Mike was kind of a pack rat, bless his heart. You know, I had quilts that were for a king-size bed. Well, I downsized to a queen. I'm never going to go to a king again. What are they doing in my storage? I've got a small house. I took them all down there. The blankets, I took probably 20 blankets down there.
Oh, nice.
And we got there at the end of assembly. I was wondering why there was nobody in the donation area. Got there at the end of assembly, so, you know, I did a little raise of hand. They did a little finger thing. And I said, for those of you camping, and I'm asking, please, the people that camping and need it most, I told them that I donated that. I said, please go get something and keep yourselves warm. So my next thing is I've been talking to restaurant owners locally, trying to set up a donate schedule. They're a little bit nervous because there was a time that Michigan had the Detroit metropolitan area had a service that would go around restaurant to restaurant and take leftovers down to soup kitchens. And
right.
Somebody sued for food poisoning.
Oh,
and so a lot of them are a little reluctant to donate the food with their money on it. I'm working on ways around that. But, you know, I went down there. I had my signs. And on one side of them, pretty much talked about my personal situation, and the other side said, by the way, I do recognize the irony in the fact that when white people begin to suffer what people of color have suffered in this country for 200 years economically, we suddenly give a fuck.
Yeah.
And, you know, my message wasn't for the black people who nod and roll their eyes and say, tell me about it. I'm like, it's not for you. You already know this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not telling you shit. It's for them. There were rich tourist types whose hearts were in the right place. A couple from Rochester were very sweet. They came up. They were the only one who actually approached the sign and took pictures of it. They close enough to talk to me a little bit. Most of the yuppie types that came down to show support, but they were taking pictures of the poor people like zoo animals. I was less than impressed with that. these people said, oh, well, we took our money out of the Rochester Bank and we put it in the credit union today and we wanted to support. And then they looked at it and they said, you know, you've got a point. We're suddenly, you know, we've been upper middle class. They trashed our 401ks. They trashed our money we had put ahead. And because we thought we were one of them, being like that your little troll earlier was saying, a millionaire, you're just barely that. This isn't about you. Unless you own 3 Learjets, we're not talking about you. The 1% isn't you. But they've gone after the middle class and the upper middle class, and suddenly when we're having to do without, like people of color have forever, it's wake the fuck up time. So mostly I sat with the black people and hung out with them, and there's still a little bit of division. I mean, there's the people camping, they're all intermingled, but you could tell the little suburbanites kept their little distance to their little groups, and they took pictures of my sign from a distance, feeling marginally guilty. But I was, they read the flip side of my sign, and I had little old ladies coming up and hugging me, going, "You'll survive this, dear. What can I do for you?" Well, you know, here's a service, and people trying to help me. They're living in tents. They're trying to make me and my son's world better. People were wonderful.
Yeah, there's little miracles happening everywhere, you know. I got one of those backdoor flash emails from some friends that put it out from, let's say, the southwestern territories of the country in the middle of, outside of Canyon de Chelly. Those folks, those elders are saying that yesterday's flyby by the asteroid was definitely a blue kachina moment, you know. And they definitely see the Occupy, you know, I'm talking about the Hopi elders. I think they're seeing the Occupy movement as a tipping point towards good, you know.
Well, I absolutely do. And I have to say, yesterday morning at 10 a.m., I felt this rush of energy and just impending good. You know how you have impending doom? Impending good, like I've never felt before in my life. And I tried to write about it last night a little bit on Facebook. But, you know, it was cloudy. I didn't see anything. You know, it's Michigan, in Michigan weather. But I felt energized. And I do. And especially, one thing that if none of you have ever been in the position of losing your home, and I've been in that position before, I look at my kid and I'm like, homes are sticks. Home is wherever we are. We can downsize. I was looking at those people living in tents and listening to them play music and laugh and live and love. And I'm like, we're okay no matter where we are. It reminded me that your stuff is not you. It reminded me that when you stick together with people and you connect and you take care of each other like they were, like I tried to, I felt better on that day than if I just, you know, had somebody put all new carpet through this house and you know what I mean? Stuff is just stuff, but connection is heaven.
You're right. You're absolutely right. A lot of people are going through these things for the first time, and it's shocking to them. They never expected it, you know? And I think people are finding out what they're made of, and I think we need to in order to survive now, because we're losing our planet, and that's our real home, you know?
It is. You know, I spent a great deal of time thinking last night and the last couple nights about a chapter that Patrice Greenville wants me to write for his book, and it basically says how I came to the left. And he's taking a lot of little snippets from different people and doing a compilation. And, you know, I think back when I moved out of my parents' house and I had this little 700-square-foot house on Napier, I had probably 14 different people live with me that I was a bartender that I'd meet in the bar that were down on their luck, thrown out by their wife or their husband, or blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, come stay with me until you get a job and move out. And that's what they do. I never, you know, kept them. And some of them I never even saw again. Some of them I gave money to. But, I mean, I've always been who I am, and I always felt like an alien freak. And now I'm starting between you and the, you know, the Roundtree 7 community, my Wild Wild Love community, the online community, and the fact that people are waking up, because sometimes it takes a little bit of great equalizer for people to wake up. I feel like more and more people are like me, and I'm not alone.
It's true. It really is true. You take me back to a long time ago when we used to live, you know, at night, make it, you know, at the local bar and grill, if you will. And I've known bartenders who I still know. Great affection for gals. But you're reminding me of how close people can get when things are, you know, needful. And we're at a needful point on the planet. It's not just us, Diane. It's people all over the planet. I feel so, for some reason, I can feel the people so closely in Greece right now. Their despair is pretty awful. They have been without for so long. And I don't think the rest of the world is really understanding. I mean, we understand that all of the children who are starving in India or, you know, down in Colombia or what have you, in a third world condition, oh, that we understand. But, you know, if you've traveled to Greece and you know Greece in your mind a certain way and you see them in a Western world lens, and you understand now that they're almost at the point of what Confederate money was during the Civil War and after the Civil War. You know what I'm saying? It's all very serious, and yet at the same time, there's this wonderful extension that we are all, and on a global level, we're reaching out to one another, like you showing up in Detroit. And it's happening over this internet, you know?
It is. I'm not as aware as I should be of what's happening in Greece. I know they're fucked, and they're like, 6 months ahead of our position, a year,
yep.
Maybe a month, who knows? You know, it's hard to say. But I do know that I've got friends that live in Mexico, and you know, not the border towns. I've got people that live, actually one of my friends, I've written about from Tenecatita, has renounced her U.S. citizenship, and she's a Mexican citizen now. And, you know, they're deeply involved in the community and whatever. And these people are poor, but they're not like, the poor, like the border towns that have to come here to fucking feed their families. They're, you know, they get by, you know, there's the bounty of the ocean and they grow things and they you know, serve the tourists in the season and they get by. Well, there's been a series of bad events there, but generally people that have learned to live with less, they learn to conserve their water. They learn to live more in balance with nature, more with Mother Earth. They're far happier than the richest people here. She's just like, I'm so far out of the American psyche now, I can't even comprehend going back to it.
I know what you're saying. I know a shop owner who's a ceremonial healer who is up in, she has a little shop called Piowackets in Alaska, and she's looking for a buyer so she can go down to Mexico and live sustainably too and heal and do actually what she wants to do is live a good life, a substantial life, a life that makes a positive difference. I mean, when did we get so far away from that?
One thing I do resent is about that, though, is there's a lot of Americans who know they can take their retirement if they have one, which not that many have, or they used to, and go down there and live like kings and let all the little brown people wait on them.
I know.
But they figure they're doing them a favor because they're spending their American dollars there, and the Mexicans that wait on them are doing better than the rest of them in the outskirts. That wasn't really my point. My point was, if you hit, now the Tenochtitlan has been hit with three disasters now. They had a horrible, first of all, a guy came in and claimed the land, and then threw them, tore down all their houses, took them out at gunpoint, blah, 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 blah. It's been over a year, and they're trying to win that battle back. Then there was a hurricane that just totally decimated the crops, and that was only a month ago. And yet, they're surviving. Now, you take Greece or Americans who are used to being the pampered pets of the rich, used to eating out of our silver little bowls and getting patted on the head, and you put us in those conditions, we're not as resilient as them. We're like, for the same reason that when I rehabilitated wolves, you don't turn them back into the loose. Once they get used to a certain condition, they can never live in harmony with the land again. They just can't. They get used to like looking for the food bowl. Well, that's Americans. We're used to like, all right, where's my paycheck so I can just get whatever I want? Austerity is going to fuck us up. And
it already has.
The point being is we should live more frugally, but it's going to be more horrifying for the Western world. And yes, we should live more frugally. But the point is, no one on this planet needs to live that frugally.
Yeah.
Because it's not 150 million lazy people, it's 400 greedy people. Do the math.
Right. Yeah. You got there. That's the truth. It really is. You know, you actually don't know how to make the case for whatever it's going to take to bring balance back, because everywhere I reach in my head, I keep wondering, how do we accomplish that? But one thing I do know, I didn't expect Occupy. And embracing it is one of the best things I can do. It is allowing me to know where to reach, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's given me hope and life and light. And, you know, I'm looking at silly things. And for those of you listening, I really recommend you go to some Occupy websites and look at their needs list. Because the obvious things are things like what I dropped off. The less than obvious things are plastic, even though, environmentally fucked up. They don't have running water to wash stuff. And we don't want people getting massively ill. Plastic forks and knives, napkins. And I looked to my other room. My rich bosses get carry out every week. And they don't want the little plastic silverware that comes wrapped with a napkin. And I always saved it. What if I have a party? I'll use this. Well, I've got two boxes of this shit. Hermetically sealed, little packages with nice forks, and they do have recycle bins there, so, you know, hey, they can go into that. But I'm like, oh, dude, never even occurred to me. I'm taking those two boxes down.
It's a lot about what I was talking about when I first began to speak on today's show. It's about realizing how rewarding and how healing and how self-sustaining being of service to the community is. It really is. It gives you so much. You have that aha moment a lot more often when you're being of service to the community or just to anyone. Moms know that very well. Mothers seem to know that. I'm not a mother. I'm a mother of my little company here. I am not a mother. But I've watched moms, and I had one. And I can understand the goddess impulse. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, totally. I want to ask you two quick questions here. First of all, I read a little blurb on Wawa Left when I went there when I got in from working and doing my weight slave shit, Occupy Wall Street just put $20,000 in Wells Fargo Bank. Have you heard about that?
No, not a bit.
Well, apparently, Occupy Oakland is voted to deposit $20,000 with Wells Fargo Bank just days after the Occupy protester shadowed the window of one of the bank's downtown branches during its attempt to stage a general strike. The decision was posted at Occupy Oakland's site for its General Assembly. According to the link, the group made the decision to deposit $20,000 with Wells at a meeting on Monday night. Wells Fargo quickly trumpeted the decision. If this report is true, it demonstrates that even Occupy Oakland understands firsthand the value and service that Wells Fargo provides its customers, Wells spokesman blah, blah, blah said.
What the fuck is that about?
You know, that's totally fucked up. Now, in the comments, Edger had said, hold on, let me scroll down here. Edger had said that the money is temporarily being placed into a Wells Fargo trust fund of lawyer Timothy Fong. It will stay there for less than 2 weeks while Occupy Oakland establishes a new unincorporated account with either credit union or community bank. And Timothy Fong himself is in the process of moving his accounts out of Wells Fargo. And he, as well as Occupy Oakland as a whole, urges other people to leave the multinational banks as well. And that was from their website. So I hadn't heard about this. I wondered if you had. I don't understand.
I don't know anything about trust funds or if
they're tax-exempt status or whatever, if they need to set that up, if there's a reason for this. If not, why the hell didn't they just throw it in any credit union until they decided where they wanted to be?
Well, speaking as someone who lived half of her life from a trust fund or two, I can tell you that basically they just manage your money. And they manage it. If I knew then what I know now, I would have had that money out of those trust funds, because those usually just place. It goes into the community trust of the bank, just making money for the bank, and it's usually the kind of a trust it is. It's one that you can take and give from, so there's very little yield from it. But basically, it's going into the major Wall Street Ponzi scheme.
Trust funds actually go on Wall Street for, they're like stocks and bonds and trading.
There's all kinds of, yes, they do.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, it's up to the trust officers in the bank to make those choices and decisions on how the money is spent in community trust for the bank day to day, just like day traders. So basically, trust officers have that capability. They have that kind of power to act. I don't see a reason, on the top of it, or from my experience, because business has changed, the business models have changed in banking so very much in the last 20 years, I don't see that they would actually need to do that kind of a rigmarole with a trust fund.
I don't know. I don't understand it either. This is kind of a breaking story. We're probably have to wait and see. Maybe they just hit $20,000 and went, who is an accountant, who can we trust, and slapped it with this guy. I think that's something that's going to come out more, but I have a second question for you. Maya Beach just posted on Facebook that Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan has just put out a statement about Occupy Oakland. And I'm going to quote her. Oakland has shown its support for the 99%. Now it's time for this encampment to show its support and respect for the people of Oakland. We renew our call on Occupy Oakland to make a decision to leave immediately.
Occupation is
a tactic, not a solution. Frank Ogawa Plaza cannot sustain permanent living quarters, and our economy cannot sustain this occupation. I am pleased to see a consensus developing on the council to remove the camp, I call on elected leaders who are clamoring for immediate raid to put forward a plan that does not cause additional injury to people, property, and in a reputation result in another reoccupation. I urge them to join me, the city administrator, the police chief, and the community leaders in implementing a plan to remove the encampment. We know that a tiny minority thinks it's a sound strategy to pit our police against demonstrators. We call on everyone to reject provocation of violence. We will talk with demonstrators, community, and the police to build a common understanding of peaceful resolution. This has been a test of leadership and a test of conscience. Oakland is a city of hope and opportunity. We are the 99%. What's your reaction to that?
Holy shit. She's stirring up hornet's nest there. You know what my first thought is? My first thought is about Oso and that he stay protected, because I know he feels very committed to the Occupy Oakland movement. And I just hope there's no, this is like a great big old horn call for violence, you know?
It is. My first initial response was, dear Jean, go fuck yourself. We stay until something changes, biatch. Suck it.
Oh, my God. Well,
you've been out here. Nothing changed. Now go home. We support you, but go home. Nothing has changed,
They do not get that the only currency, the only capital that these folks have are their bodies. It's the only capital you have, or I have, when it comes right down to it, in the face of this kind of government strife and this kind of government overlording. You only have... Your currency is only your body, and that's what they're using. I heard Amy Goodman say that, you know, she figured that possibly they would have to move, or was it David Crosby that said it to Keith Olbermann that they might have to move, out of Fuccotti Park. But they're not going to. They actually just got the tents they needed. They're not going to willingly take off yet. That is not what has been put out. You know, Fuccotti Park, Occupy Wall Street, of which everyone around the globe is anchored to, that calls himself Occupy. They have anchored to, I don't know if folks, if Americans, even all of us fans realize, and us people who are actually part of it, I don't think we all realize that all over the planet right now, all over the planet, people use Occupy Wall Street and that little group at Fuccotti Park as an anchor to the whole movement. And that's something unreal,
huge.
Incredible. It's huge. Thousands of people in Spain today. It is huge. But what you just told me about what Mayor Kwan, it's Kwan, right?
Yeah.
Has dictated to Ogallala Park out there. She threw down a gauntlet is what she's done, and she knows damn good and well that's what she's done. If she,
well,
you know,
here's a two prong little thing, because you know when the police made their little statement, we had a discussion on Journey with Roundtree 7 on Facebook, which is a great group. Anybody listening who has not joined, please do. We had a great discussion of whether or not it was COINTELPRO or if the police were sincere. So now we have the cops saying, Kwan made us do it. Now we have Kwan saying city council members and other leaders of the community who want us to raid them, I'm asking you to leave peaceably. She's passing the gauntlet again to faceless, nameless people who want the raid. I think you're right. This is a call for violence. This is a way to come out ahead of time and shed guilt. And I think asking them to leave while nothing changes is absurd.
But nobody's believing it for a minute, especially after the cops shot the guy. 212, the 5161, is the mic is open.
Hello. It's Trish.
Hey,
had two things. Hello.
Hey, Trish.
Hold on.
I took you off the speaker because I can't tell if you, anyway. One is the troop movements. Remember over the summer, this past summer, the military was moving heavy equipment retrofitted to fire non-lethal weapons toward California. There's video on it at Worldwide Hippies. And, you know, there was all that troop movement, so the National Guard would have the artillery in case of civil unrest over the economy.
Oh, God.
All right, so number one, it makes sense that they're trying, if somebody's going to throw down the gauntlet, it would make sense that it was in Oakland, given the troop, the equipment move, the trucks, and they sent tanks. I don't know if they've moved any people, but over the summer they sent equipment. And then number two, about nurturing the movement, you were talking, Gwen, about Zuccotti Park, and it's metaphorical significance, if you will, around the world. And you know, I've been there a few times. You know, and so anyway, it's I think people are aware of its significance down there, I mean, but also that's why we have to nurture it, and that's why, you know, we have to keep it together, and we have to grow it through the winter, and that goes for Detroit, too, and in your Occupies. I saw something today of a little Occupy in Worcester, Massachusetts, I think, and I know, you know, it hasn't been giant, Gwen, but it's been growing, and it's been going, and they're hanging together, and we do need to nurture the movement. And that's another thing mothers do, is nurture stuff.
Speak to it, goddess. Speak to it, goddess. Yes.
You know.
Can I speak to Trish for a second here?
Sure.
First of all, I think you're wonderful and awesome. You just, like, you know, your writing is right there, and you think like I think, and I totally respect, love reading you. But really, one thing I know this is going to sound tinfoil hat-ish. 2-3 years ago, Gottlieb and I were predicting all this. We were predicting the austerity measures, the shock doctrine here. It's all come to pass. The economic shit, it's all come to pass. And we were told, oh, my God, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And we're like, it is. Hello.
It is.
But, you know, I do have to speak to the fact that there's, and I just tried to Google it real quick in my essays. Why in the world has Halliburton built, like, 180 facilities and prison facilities that are sitting empty, looking like
don't
a tournament
be,
camp?
Get,
and
don't
supposedly,
get me started on Dick fucking Cheney and Halliburton. But no kidding, yes. And, I mean, one of the things
there's
that...
There's probably ICE for immigration camps. I'm sorry.
But also, look at the level at which the black community is incarcerated. I heard this, like, years ago, a guy named Manning Marable, I think is his name, or maybe it's Marable Manning. He's passed recently. But he did a bunch of work about Malcolm X. He was a black studies professor at Columbia, and he was on a panel with Cornel West and some other folks after, it was one time when George Bush was elected. When George Bush won the presidency, anyway, on this thing about what are we going to do now, and they were talking about the level that, you know, you get thrown in jail when you're young and you lose your voting rights. You know, and so anyway, I can see that there's the prison industrial complex is sorely as active and influential in money making America as military, I would say. I mean, that's what I'm hearing you talk about, Diane. Is that what you're talking about?
Well,
you know
what I'm talking about. Go ahead,
Florida. Down here in South Florida, they tried to start building prisons this month, and one of our legislators, one of our Democrat legislators, called a halt to it, said, you know, that this asshack governor couldn't overrule, especially all the unions. Of course, we are a unionless state. But the point is that they were their government, their state-paid employees, and he went about it the wrong way. And so now those prisons that they're planning on building, huge new ones, big ones, are not going up. They were forestalled. So I understand what PE is, what Trish is talking about.
Well, yeah, and that's part of it, Trisha. But this is a little bit outside of that box. And if I can find, I did a whole very well-researched paper on it two years ago. I'll try and bring up and I'll post on your blog for you or give to you to post.
Wonderful.
Or whatever you want to do with it. But these are internment camps. These are immigration camps, and basically it comes back to a bunch of papers that actually Ollie North had something to do with about emergency government and emergency backup things should there be civil unrest. We have large detention facilities sitting empty, not prisons. Of course, it's part of the prison industrial complex. They're subsidized by our government. We have detention facilities for just this thing sitting empty.
So that's your new report. That what you're telling me? Oh my God.
I don't think. Here's the other part about that, ladies. I really don't think. I mean, you've seen how many people replace the ones who get arrested and who, you know, you screw with them. And basically, more people start showing up. It's a guaranteed way to recruit for Occupy is to accost them with the state militia. If they pull that,
if I can totally believe those guys would appropriate millions and trillions of dollars to with this very thing of, well, you know, one of my favorite songs is about what right-wing, conservative Christian right-wing Republican straight white America males by Todd Snyder. And he talks about those guys are not going to be satisfied until we're all locked up in jail. And they've been wanting to lock us up ever since before so that he would spend all that money. I mean, we're talking about a guy that invented a Halliburton loophole, for God's sake, so we can have fracking. These are bad people who think they can make money off of anything, and of course they would.
They are. They're the dungeon.
Really?
I
think there's still a First Amendment challenge that ultimately what we're looking at is in the occupation is going up against the Supreme Court practically or probably about First Amendment rights. And if we have to get Clarence Thomas off the court first, that's what we have to do. But I don't know how. But I think that's where it's going, and I don't know.
You call Cornel West, Dr. Brother Cornel West, and you tell him we need his help getting the son of a bitch off the Supreme Court.
He's
trying his best, and we just call him and let him know we need him to try more, better, harder, longer. You know.
That's what the church
like
lady had to. Well, the church ladies had to convince Martin Luther King to take a more active role too. So, you know, maybe that's what Brother Cornell needs. But we'll find out. I think I can hear thousands of cynical people saying, you know, this will never happen, and maybe it won't ever really happen. But that doesn't mean you don't try.
I can't go there with you. It will happen. Because you know what? We've been the route. We went through the Great Depression, which was caused by the exact same thing. We went the route of being thrown a few bones by the New Deal, and we got to see, we had a good middle class for a short time because they could exploit the rest of the world. But they no longer need us. They don't need our hours of worth to them in work in production. They don't, because they can outsource that. They don't need our purchasing power because now the elites are selling to the elites and they can sell the cars to Dubai and let us lease them for a little bit. They don't need us. They can, and while we were doing well as middle class, we totally ignored the fact the rest of the world was impoverished because they didn't even let us look at it to make us middle class. Now we have this internet. Now we see that this whole world has been impressed, this globe has been impressed by this cabal of Wall Street people. And we're never, you can't put an idea, you can't make an idea go away. This idea is out there. And it doesn't matter if Americans get scared or lazy. It's a global movement, and it's not going to end until it changes. Amen.
Well, right. That's basically what I was saying at the beginning of this program. I don't think that we have to lose, you know, I'm a constitutionalist, I think, in my own mind. I think the First Amendment goes a long way. I think we have to reclaim it. I know large changes have to happen. Look at people are, there's no clear avenue or pathway, but at one that keeps resoundingly clear in my head and almost everyone I know who's involved in the Occupy movement, and that is that this must be a peaceful movement. We have to use our bodies as the currency. And that's what will work. That's what will make a successful change. Anything else is just, you know, it's going to come down to smoke and ash, you know?
Punk Patriot always says, you know, when he's coming back again tomorrow, I'm so excited. And anyway, he always says that police know how to deal with violence because they're trained to deal. That's all they understand. What they don't know how to deal with is peace.
That's true.
And so if they don't know what to do, that doesn't mean you're not in danger if you're in a peaceful movement, clearly. But they're willing. And again, that's something we nurture. Even when, I mean, even you, the way things are, just because you think it's peaceful doesn't mean it is. I mean, those cops are tricky bastards.
It doesn't mean it's
going to stay. Excuse me, ladies. I'm gonna set you down for one moment if you lose me.
Well, I'm just saying that our people are at risk when they are out there.
Now,
so say what?
You know, the power is going out.
Oh dear.
I'm sorry, Tricia.
Because
I'm looking at your name instead of talking to you. I do think we have to be mindful. I've been in one situation where, you know, the protest went bad, and basically what happened was we were all basically arrested, taken away in paddy wagons, and this was in Ithaca, New York, where there weren't that many paddy wagons, so it was like an all-day friggin' affair, and we sat there in handcuffs. You know, the plastic stuff was still good then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really an experience. I've still got a little scar because I was cut, you know. It's not pleasant at all. It's not a big game. It's not a big party. When the police come knocking, and you've seen what's gone on in New York, I think people realize when they see this guy who was with Keith Olbermann last night, who got shot, and he filmed it. Did you see that? Getting shot point blank by the Oakland police. It's rubber bullets kill people, too. And there's a lot of danger associated with this. But the point is that it has to be done. Where else do we turn? No place else to go. Diane, are you back?
I am back. I love your heart and your golly spirit in hoping that this can be the 100th monkey moment. All I know is that with this much power coagulated and clotting, and I use coagulated instead of coalesced for a reason because it's foul. And coalesced globally, they wield the world's armies. They wield the world's private armies, which XE type people. they wield the ability to bribe those of lesser morals, there will be violence against us. And I do think that eventually, yeah, there's going to be some ash. I don't look forward to it. I don't want it. I do know if somebody came to my door with guns drawn wanting me and Jake, I'd go out fighting to save my son, self-defense, not looking for a war, not looking for violence. But I really do think there's going to be, you know, why do you think that in the last year or two on all the science channels, they've shown all the microwave weapons and the ear weapons that they can incapacitate a crowd of, you know, 1,000 and bring them to their knees immediately? Why do you think that Homeland Security has been training? I live in a community of maybe 3,000, and Homeland Security even trained my cops. I mean, really?
They can't wait to deploy those. I'm surprised it's taken them this long, because those people who like that shit can't wait to use it. Look at Obama and his drones.
Hey, ladies. Okay, I get it. I see where you're going. Your point is very clear. It's not gonna get anywhere until there's huge sacrifice and la 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 I know the arguments, but I know that I do sound like the Pollyanna, and perhaps I am a cosmic Pollyanna. I have no doubt you do. I'm not turning this around a bit. I know you want that. And the only way I could see to do it, because that's my integrity, that's who I am. I am a healer. Mind you, if somebody came up and started beating on someone next to me, I'd go fucking monkey wild. You know, you protect what you love and you care for, and I love and care for my friends and the people who are surrounding me. And, you know, I certainly care about my Occupy group. However, we're peaceful, and there's a way to go low. And you know, they can't, what are they going to do, murder you? Because if you're this is what, when they turn
there's
the
only
whole,
one way it will work. There's
look,
one way,
and they
one way
the,
only, it will work peacefully, Gwen.
And look,
you know, I've said it, and I've said it, and nobody ever takes it seriously.
When they turned the hoses and the dogs onto the people who marched with MLK, and when they accidentally shot one person at Kent State, I mean, things changed massively politically in this country. It wasn't just a turning of a page, but there are more people, there's a greater awakening going on, and the thing you have to do is remain peaceful. You know, if they come at you, you know, if they come to your front door, you of course you would defend yourself. But I don't think that the police are going to come grabbing people. That kind of fascism goes on. We're talking a whole different thing, Diane. We're talking about the suspension of this government as we know it, aren't we?
We're talking about what people in power have always done. I can cite the Battle of Caracas. The Battle for Chile. When people went on a general strike there, what they did was they pulled out a couple people and shot them in the street and said, "You will get back to work." Literally went to people's homes, dragged them out at gunpoint and made them go to work, shooting a couple of them to scare the rest of them. If I can finish this point, I keep trying to start. Will work ever, ever peacefully is if by this electronic device, this mind God interactive thing that makes us all be able to connect. You know, we used to want to be able to psychically connect. Well, this is a way to do it. If all of us, worldwide, sit down and say, "I'm not paying another dollar." The people we bought our house from, they've been paid. We're not paying another dollar. We're not doing one more step of work and we're not buying a fucking thing. And it will take the whole world to just sit down one day. Just sit down.
Workers of the world unite. Workers of the world unite.
We're here talking today about Occupy Wall Street. There's occupation all over the planet. Did you guys ever think in your wildest dreams that this would be happening so fast?
I just think that it's so glorious that this is moving around, and it's certainly not without risk. But, you know, the thing about military fear-mongering is that's what another way that we're oppressed when we don't act out of fear. And that's not to say these bad guys, I mean, because we're talking about, you know, Halliburton, for God's sake. And look what they did to the Gulf. They wreak havoc. But we still have to do what we have to do. And we need to be motivated in our own, and our own love for each other and self and planet. I don't know what's going to happen. I just know what can drive. I can't predict. I don't know what's going to happen.
There is no denying what Diane is saying. That is a very, very plausible outcome. But this isn't Chile. You can't drag people into the street and shoot them.
Oh, you can't? They haven't but that doesn't mean they can't.
Hey, wait a minute. You're right. Right. They've done it in New York City. But then there's a trial. There's a trial. There's a victim. You know, that happens. If you do that here, we've seen what it produces every time that they have gotten violent. And if the mayor of Oakland has put out a, you know, What do you call that? She's given them an ultimatum. She's given them an ultimatum. And you do that and throw down the gauntlet that way, knowing that these people are committed and they're not going to, you know, give it up. There's going to be violence, and if there is more, you know, they figure close to 100,000 people showed up to close down the port of Oakland. You think 100,000 people can't handle the police departments or even the National Guard? That would be the dissolution of the government. You know what I'm saying? Am I wrong?
The problem is that when the 100 or 1,000 police are pointing their guns, can you rush them?
Yeah.
Are you going to run up first? Every person on that line has to go, I'm going to die today, and I'm willing to die today.
I know I'm not going to rush them. I'm going to maintain a peaceful resistance. And if I get shot, that was the commitment I made. Okay.
And when they start shooting bullets, you might not turn and run. I mean, we all do.
Even if you're stunned with the sound waves and your brain is exploding, that's what's going to happen. The military will attack us and try to jail us all. Okay, fine. They're going to start in Oakland. The bitch has sent the letter. They're ready to go. Let's go. They can't wait to burst our spleen too and leave us to vomit in our own puke and diarrhea like they just did to Soto Cry. What if they do that? Then everybody's going to film it. It'll be on YouTube everywhere, and we'll do whatever we do. There's no way to know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Out of revolution, you know, there's no way. There really is no way. Diane certainly has a point. We simply don't know what's going to happen. Now, this all began in Tunisia, remember? You guys?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do. The man burned himself because every time he put up a cart, the cops would take his cart away. He was just trying to sell his wares, and they kept taking it away from him.
Roundtree7.com, the blog, began in the wake of that act. That's when we all started to do what we were doing. We got together and said, we've got to write about what is in our hearts and our integrity, about the wrong things that are going on right now. That was when we got together because of that. You know, it was around that. It wasn't because we, you know, jumped a ship or did anything else. It was because we all wanted to write something that would be significant, a knowledge to the social consciousness. Because the social consciousness is transforming right now. We're in a paradigm shift. We genuinely are. There is a shift going on. It's best, I think, to cling to the goodness of it and fight for the rightness that is there for us, rather than, you know, to anticipate that it's all going to come to a conflict that can be violent. I would rather embrace the peaceful, you know, march of it. And basically...
I totally agree with you. I guess my point is, even Gandhi himself said, there's a man who came to Gandhi and said, I want to be nonviolent. He said, then you need to do what I did. Join the military, learn how to handle a gun, take it apart, put it back together, shoot, blah, blah, blah. Until you've used violence, you can't choose nonviolence. I'm not saying to do that. I'm just offering a quote up. Now, what I'm trying to do to your audience, not specifically you, but to people listening, is saying we want the best possible nonviolent goals. But you cannot walk in unprepared or unaware or completely alert of the danger and be able to make that choice. Otherwise, you're going in like sheep to the slaughter. You have to look around. You have to see where your exits are.
You know,
in any situation, you have to be painfully aware that they're going to.
That's supposition, though, Diane. It really is. That's, you know, there's going to be tests.
But Gwen, I mean, just from a be prepared Girl Scout standpoint, I mean, if you're going into that situation, you know, bring your goggles, you know. I mean, be aware and make a correct.
Exactly.
Of course, I've gone through the fucking training for being in a protest movement. It was in 1975, but I've gone through that.
But I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to your audience, and we have not. I'm saying you need the goggles, like Trisha's saying. I'm saying you need to know what to do for tear gas and what to do for this and what to do for that. And look, you know, because we're nonviolent doesn't mean they will be. You have to be prepared.
Right. Yes. Well, no, our Occupy group has discussed what different, because the Occupy, if you go to OccupyTogether.org, there's all kinds of different stuff that informs you and gives you all of the information on how to prepare yourself for, tear gas and what can happen from being hit by, you know, tear gas. And bean bags especially, and I didn't see anything on rubber bullets, but we discussed all that. That was part of our General Assembly. Wasn't it part of, I see. I've only been down to my General Assembly when it meets once a week. That's all. I have to stay home, you know, and I get everything through live stream. You know, I'm with it, you know, so many hours of the day through live stream. But I do think that people are getting some education in how to be prepared for the violence that the police will, you know.
Now, I don't know about Occupy specifically. I know Stop the Machine, October 2011, has certainly done preliminary trainings because they were more prepared prior to the action than Occupy was. Huh?
Ladies, we're about to get cut off.
Oh, it's about that time.
Thank you, Diane.
Well, it's nice being here. Thanks, ladies. A great discussion.
Hey,
yes,
thank
absolutely.
You so much.
Sure.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Tricia. I didn't realize we really got into the discussion. Tomorrow we're back again at 5 p.m. for Hear Me Monsters. And, pin stuff up on the wall over there at Roundtree, Journey to Roundtree 7 on Facebook, and we'll discuss it. The last thing I do say tonight, I want to say that Diane had an excellent point, and she's saying be prepared. She's right. And perhaps this weekend or on Friday, she will have something to say on her show over at the Wild Wild Left about it. Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Tricia. Thank you, Sandy and Janelle and all of the people listening. Certainly do appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow. And stay safe out there. And occupy yourself, okay, tonight. That's a good thing, not a bad thing, okay? They're going to cut me off.